Welcome to episode 259 of FBI Retired Case File Review with Jerry Williams. I'm a retired agent on a mission to show you who the FBI is and what the FBI does through my award-winning books, blog, and podcast case reviews with former colleagues. Today, we get to speak to, once again, retired agent Dave Nadowski, who served in the FBI for 21 years. Dave was assigned to the Detroit, Atlanta, New York, and Boston field offices. In this episode, he reviews the 1997 multi-agency investigation of the disappearance of 10-year-old Jeffrey Curley from in front of his grandmother's house in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the failed polygraph examination that led to the confession of one of the predators responsible for the kidnapping and murder of the little boy. During his career, Dave conducted investigations involving foreign counterintelligence matters, public corruption, civil rights violations, bank robberies and major crimes, gang investigations, and government fraud violations. He ended his career in the Boston Division as a squad supervisor. Since his bureau retirement, Dave has worked as a licensed private investigator, a corporate security supervisor, and most recently, a realtor. Dave is the author of The Con and the FBI Agent, An Unlikely Alliance. The true crime story features the Loomis Fargo vault sting, the biggest investigation of Dave's career, and his relationship with the informant who helped him solve the case. Dave reviewed the case on FBI Retired Case File Review, episode 130. Please note that I am issuing a trigger alert warning for this Jeffrey Curley child kidnapping and murder case review. There are many difficult moments during the interview. One description I admit to editing out because it was so disturbing and heartbreaking. People who violate a child this way are pure evil. Now, before we get to the interview, I want to remind Reader Team members that I sent out my May email on Monday, May 2nd. If it's not in your inbox, you know what to do. Check your spam filter and your promotions tab. I share a sad story about my new puppy, Bruno. Luckily, it has a happy ending. I want to welcome new listeners. In your podcast app's description of this episode, there are links to where you can join my reader team to keep up to date on the FBI and books, TV, and movies, buy me a coffee, and visit my website to learn more about me and my nonfiction and crime fiction books. I want to thank you for your support. Now here's the show. I want to welcome my guest who's back for another episode, Dave Nadowski. Hey, Dave, how are you?
Hey, I'm great, Jerry. Thank you for having me today.
Well, the first thing I have to say is congratulations, because you've recently released your first book called The Con and the FBI Agent, An Unlikely Alliance. And the most exciting thing about this new book for me, featured heavily in the book, is the case that we talked about in episode 130. Which was about the Loomis Fargo vault sting and your informant who played a vital role in the successful conclusion of that case. So congratulations.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Yeah, my informant was outstanding and played a vital role. In fact, put his life on the line, believe it or not. It was a great case. I think the readers will be very interested in this book once they start reading.
Great. We'll talk a little bit more about the book and the case at the end of this interview, but we're here today to talk about a very sad, sad case, and that is the abduction and murder of little Jeffrey Curley. Now, as we start this case review, I just want to let everybody know that you are recovering from the flu. We've actually rescheduled this interview. I hope your voice is going to hold up all right. I hope we're not going to tax it too much today.
I don't think we will. It should get better as time goes on, hopefully.
Where do you want to start? Do you want to start by telling us about who Jeffrey Curley was, or do you want to start when the FBI was pulled into this abduction investigation?
I'll give you a brief intro to Jeff and then get right into the case itself. Jeff Curley was born in 1987. He was the third son to Robert, a Cambridge, Massachusetts firefighter, and Barbara Curley. Cambridge, as many people may know, is a suburban city on the border with Boston, and it's home to Harvard University. On October 1st, 1997, 10-year-old Jeffrey was last seen going to his grandmother's house in Cambridge to wash her dog. He got to his grandmother's house and told his grandmother he'd be back in 10 minutes, that he needed to do something. Unfortunately, that was the last time Jeffrey was seen alive. The family reported Jeff missing when he failed to return home, and searches began the next day. The Boston FBI was aware of the missing boy, but we were not called in for assistance by the Cambridge PD until 6 p.m., one day after Jeffrey was reported missing.
Could you tell everybody why the Cambridge Police Department called the FBI? I'm sure it's a missing child, it's an abduction. So kind of talk about how the FBI gets invited to participate in a case like this.
Sure. Broadly, the FBI is known for investigating missing persons if the missing persons are suspected of being missing due to foul play. In this particular case, since a child was involved, Cambridge PD was reaching out, hoping that they could get our assistance to join their investigative team, the more the merrier, and bring our expertise in this type of investigation to the case. That call came into the SAC's office, who immediately notified my squad, C6, which investigated violent crimes. Our squad supervisor, John Trahan, called the squad together and reported to us that a solid lead was developed by Cambridge PD, and we were directed to drive immediately to the Cambridge Police Headquarters. John Trahan pulled me aside and said he wanted me to be case agent on this particular case. Just to explain what a case agent is, it's the director of the case. In my estimation, I was honored to fill that role. Upon arrival at the Cambridge PD, we were taken aside by Sergeant Pat Nagel. He said the Cambridge PD and Massachusetts State Police had identified two suspects in the case, and one of them, whose name was Salvatore Sicari, a 21-year-old Cambridge resident, was sitting in the interview room. We were further told by Sergeant Nagel that it was determined Jeffrey was last seen getting into a car with Sal Sicari and Sicari's friend Charles Janes. This was down the street from Jeffrey's grandmother's house. We went right into the interview room, sat down, me, Sergeant Nagel, Detective Silvio Ferreira from the Cambridge Police Department sat down and started speaking with Sal Sicari. As I sat down in the interview room, I saw Sal Sicari. He was about 21 years old. He was skinny. He was very nervous. I asked if he knew who we were, and he said, yes, he was told that we were the FBI. And I said, are you willing to speak to us about the information you have on this case? He initially said that he believed his friend Charles Janes may have had something to do with Jeffrey's disappearance. So when that was said, alarm bells are going off in our head. Sal was tense and nervous, but when asked why he thought Janes may have hurt Jeffrey, he just said he had a bad feeling about Janes. At this point, the Mass State Police Troopers had already located Janes' car at a dealership where he was working as a car detailer. They arrested him on an outstanding warrant and seized his car. We continued to interview Sicari, who remained fairly vague, but was still pointing a finger at Janes without getting specific. I looked at Sicari and asked if he would consent to a polygraph so we could rule him out as a suspect in this case. Surprisingly, he agreed.
Of course, polygraph examinations are so controversial about whether they're accurate or not, but they definitely work as an investigative tool, as a way to get people to confess.
Yes, absolutely. I left the room and called Agent Tom Donlin, our polygrapher. I filled him in on what we knew and asked for him to haul ass for Cambridge PD. The polygraph, sometimes called a lie detector, is actually a machine that basically measures heartbeat, respiration, and perspiration, and charts when these reactions increase, decrease, or remain the same. The person who is being administered the test will be able to tell which questions are causing the subject problems. By this point, the subject knows he's blowing it, and Sakari was really blowing it. Tom Dylan called a halt to the test and met with the rest of us in another room. Tom said that Sakari was definitely lying and holding something back based on his test results. So we decided to confront Sakari with the results. Tom and I walked back into the interview room, and Sakari was seated there with his head in his hands. I approached him and told him he flunked the polygraph test and was definitely lying to us. At that point, I just stopped talking and let it sink in. And as if a switch was thrown in his head, Sakari jumped up, grabbed the metal table, and violently upended it and screamed out, "You got me!" Then sat back down and started sobbing. He got up again and began wandering around the room and walked over to the window. He moved the curtain aside and looked three stories down to the street. I was suddenly very afraid he was going to go out the window head first. Tom Donnellan and I quickly moved up next to him, tried to get him to sit down. With the help of two more police officers, we finally got Sakari to sit down. At this point, Sakari was through lying, and he told us a terrible story. Sakari said he and Charles Janes picked up Jeffrey outside his grandmother's house. They were taking Jeffrey to buy him a bicycle. Sakari was driving the car, and Janes was in the back seat with Jeffrey. Just to explain something a little further, Jeffrey did know both of these guys and had spoken to them on several occasions.
Were they friends of the family? Why would he know somebody so much older than him?
Sal Sakari was known to the family. Janes was not. That's basically how they got to know Jeffrey. Jeffrey knew these guys from earlier encounters. Sakari said he and Charles Janes picked up Jeffrey outside the grandmother's house. And as I said, they were taking him to buy a bicycle. With Sakari behind the wheel and Janes in the backseat with Jeffrey, they stopped at a mobile gas station for gas. Janes got out and filled the tank. He also poured gas onto a rag. Janes got back into the backseat of the car with Jeffrey and directed Sakari to drive behind a supermarket. Janes got on top of Jeffrey and covered his face with the gas-soaked rag. Jeffrey struggled but could not budge Janes, who weighed over 200 pounds. Eventually, the fight was over, and Janes told Sakari to pull into a parking lot. Sakari looked into the back seat and knew Jeffrey was dead. Janes closed Jeffrey's eyes and duct taped Jeffrey's face to hold the gas soaked rag in his mouth. They moved his body to the floor of the back seat, and then they drove to a car dealership where Janes had a job detailing cars that day. Upon arriving, Janes went to work, and Sakari pulled the car behind the dealership. He took a blue tarp and spread it out in the trunk, then transferred Jeffrey's dead body to the trunk. Sakari said he waited for Janes to finish work, and at around 8:30 p.m., Janes and Sakari left the dealership with Jeffrey's body in the trunk of the car.
Was this the plan, to abduct him and kill him right away? I mean, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
It was our impression later on that Janes was definitely going to have sex with the boy and most likely kill him afterwards. I'm convinced this was a premeditated event. They drove to a Bradley's department store and purchased a large blue Rubbermaid container for $40. It was dark green on the top, light green on the bottom. They then went to a Home Depot and bought a bag of cement and a bag of lime. After that, they drove into Manchester, New Hampshire, across the state line from Massachusetts, where Janes had an apartment. They arrived shortly after midnight. Janes carried Jeffrey's body upstairs, and Sakari carried the Rubbermaid container, the cement, the lime, and the duct tape. Sakari said Janes put Jeffrey's body on the kitchen floor and removed all his clothes. Janes then had sex with the dead body. This might be a good time to mention that Carl Janes was a card-carrying member of NAMBLA, which stands for North American Man-Boy Love Association, which pretty much leaves nothing to the imagination when describing this particular organization.
It certainly is contrary to his actual behaviors. Nothing that you talked about says anything that equals love.
Absolutely. The love mentioned in this title, I believe, it's sexual love. Sicari said at this point, they began preparing the plastic container for Jeffrey's body, and they began by pouring cement into the container. Then they set Jeffrey's body into the container. They covered his face with the lime, then put the cover on the container and duct taped it all up so that it couldn't come off. Janes cut the bottom off of Jeffrey's jeans to keep as a trophy. At around 2 a.m., they carried the container to the trunk of Janes' car and moved the car 2 blocks away. At around 3 a.m., Janes declared it was time to move the body. Janes said he knew a good spot in Maine where they could dispose of the body. Janes started driving, and eventually, at around 5:20 a.m., he stopped on a narrow 2-lane road bridge over a slow-moving river. Janes popped the trunk, and they removed the container with Jeffrey's body. They rested the container on a metal guardrail and then just let it splash into the river. Sicari noted there were lily pads in the water. The river itself was only about 30 feet across. Sicari described the guardrail as being a W-shaped rail with cement behind the rail, and the river was a slow-moving river. A house was located next to the river, and a dog barked, and the lights in the house came on. Therefore, the two slowly drove away, but did not see anyone come out of the house. By this time in our investigation, it was approximately 3 a.m., and Sicari said he might be able to recognize the bridge and the river if he saw it again. That night, Sicari was not able to retrace the route to the river. We decided to reconvene the next day at the Portsmouth, New Hampshire Police Department. We assembled a group of 29 officers and agents from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Kittery, Maine, Massachusetts State Police, Dover, New Hampshire Police, Cambridge, Mass Police, Maine Marine Patrol, New Hampshire Fish and Game, and Maine State Police dive team, along with FBI agents.
United Health Group is looking for customer service representatives to make a difference from the comfort of home, all supported by industry-leading benefits. Make a difference daily while building your future. Visit careers.uhg.com or click the banner to apply.
We described the river as it had been described to us by Sicari. We felt sure the description would ring a bell with someone in our large group. A trooper with the Maine State Police raised his hand and said he knew where that bridge was. He said it sounded a lot like a bridge on Route 236 over the Great Works River in South Berwick, Maine. Other people in the group started talking amongst one another, and the feeling came up that there was general agreement with this assessment, so it was decided to check that location and put divers in the water. A command post was set up near the bridge, and the dive team entered the water. Visibility was poor due to the heavy sediment, and after 2 hours, the search was called off. Despite the lack of finding any evidence in the river, the general consensus remained that this location on the Great Works River was still the closest bet to match the description provided by Sicari. So the next day, divers went in again. The Boston FBI evidence response team was standing by to take custody of the plastic container if it was located. Approximately 2.5 hours into the search, divers rose from the water approximately 100 yards downstream next to a large tree which had fallen into the water. They frantically signaled and called out that they had located the container. So Boston ERT took over the recovery. News helicopters had been in the sky for 2 days and were now focusing on the activity in the water. And the evening news showed footage of 5 FBI ERT members, including myself, in the water struggling to haul the container onto the riverbank. A Maine medical examiner van was backed up to the riverbank and opened its back doors. We gently carried, then lifted, the container into the van. It was, as Sal Sicari described, 2-tone green Rubbermaid container wrapped all up with duct tape. The body was transported to the medical examiner's office in Augusta, Maine. The autopsy confirmed that Jeffrey Curley's death was consistent with the facts presented to us by Sal Sicari. Obviously, Sal Sicari and Carl Janes were arrested, charged, and lodged in the Cambridge County Jail. And at this point in the investigation, the discussion became relevant to who would prosecute this heinous crime, the U.S. Attorney's Office or the state of Massachusetts. The one weakness the Assistant United States Attorney thought the case had for federal prosecution was a lot of the description of events were presented by a guy who actually committed the crime, and therefore doubt could be raised as to the things he said. However, the state didn't have that problem. They had a clear-cut murder in their jurisdiction and would be a case easier to prove in court. Therefore, it was finally decided that the case would be tried by the state of Massachusetts.
At this point, what kind of evidence do you have other than what Sicari is telling you that shows that Janes was involved in this?
The state police impounded the car, Carl Janes' car, and actually found receipts for the lime, for the container, for the cement that he had left in the car. His car, his receipts, and his fingerprints on him. So that was pretty conclusive that he had involvement personally.
One of the things in looking at this case, kind of doing my pre-interview research, is that I saw that Sicari was charged with first-degree murder, but Janes was only charged and convicted of second-degree murder, when, from what you're telling me, he was the one who actually killed Jeffrey Curley. Tell us a little bit about that decision to charge them differently.
Well, I hope no criminals are listening to this, because the reason that occurred was Sicari sat down and confessed, told us all the facts as they occurred according to him. Carl Janes never opened his mouth ever to speak about this crime. He didn't answer one question from the state police or anybody else. He had no confession that he was going to make. And therefore, the idea was that in court, they couldn't raise any confession by Janes and could only raise the allegations presented by Sicari. Therefore, it turned out that Sicari doomed himself by talking to us and was convicted of first degree murder. And the state's attorneys from Massachusetts were only able to obtain a second degree conviction based on the defense presented that Janes never admitted to anything.
If Sicari had not made this confession, what type of evidence was there to connect him to the murders? You talked about Janes having fingerprints and then the receipts for the items that were used to dispose the body. What did you have against Sicari?
We didn't have anything other than what he told us. He confessed. That was it. He told us what he knew and the facts and led us to the site where the body was found. But there was no direct physical evidence tying him to this particular crime.
Okay, so I see what you mean by hoping that there are no murderers or people who are contemplating murdering somebody listening to this, because it does sound like the confession was the key to solving this case.
It was, absolutely. We would have never found that body without that confession, and we definitely wouldn't have known who did it. We would have had our suspicions, but we would have not had anything solid to go on. Unless those small pieces of paper were actually discovered and tied to Janes.
Right. And the body recovered several states away.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the trial, because now you have a solid confession. Did Sicari decide to plea, or did he take this to trial, and were he and Charles Janes tried together?
They were tried separately, and he, on advice of his lawyer, didn't make any statements in court, and everything was dependent upon his confession. And his confession did help to sink Janes as well, but neither one of them testified in court at all.
It sounds like Sicari might have done himself a little better if he had pled guilty and testified against Janes.
He may have, that's true. But because there was no statements anyway, other than his pointing a finger at Janes, Janes wasn't admitting to anything at all. And had he come out in court and testified truthfully, he probably would have done better. But I'm really not sure. I mean, the blood was up, really up as a result of this. And in fact, the state decided to attempt to reenact the death penalty because of this case. They had gotten rid of the death penalty years before. The state legislature took a vote to reinstate the death penalty. And it came down to one vote against the death penalty, put that vote in the majority. So the motion failed by one vote. And I'm really not an advocate of the death penalty. I don't personally feel that the threat of a death penalty will prevent somebody from doing a crime that they're contemplating doing because they are contemplating getting caught. So I really applaud the moral courage of that one legislator who held out. He was not a popular guy after that. He got a lot of threats himself. I personally feel it took a heck of a lot of courage for him to hold up to his beliefs. And it would have been easy to go along with it, with the crowd, and just reinstate the death penalty. But that's not what he was about. I wish other lawmakers had his backbone.
I know one of the things that I found interesting in reading about this case was that Jeffrey Curley's father changed his mind, too, about the death penalty.
Right. This happens over time when things cool down and you begin to think about everything logically. Even his dad, the victim's dad, decided the death penalty was a bad idea.
In trial, you testified. Did you testify in both?
Yes, I was there both. My testimony was about my involvement. My involvement was taking the confession and finding the body in the water where we looked. And that was about it on my end.
I was listening to another podcast that was about this case, but the distinction between what we do here is that we're talking about the investigation. And of course, in other true crime shows, they're talking more about the leading up to it and all of that. You know, she was talking about the fact that Jeffrey at 10 was basically on his own. His mother was working full time. And even though his grandmother took care of him, he still would be able to go from his home to her home to just hanging out all by himself. I think for those of us listening to you talk about Jeffrey at the age of 10, being able to say, I got something to do and just leaving is just shocking because, of course, today, you never would think about letting your 10-year-old child just run around freely like that. But back then in 1997, I guess things were a little different.
Yeah, it was a little looser. Though I will say that I think Jeff was allowed to have a lot more freedom than he should have. He had older brothers. They clearly did what they wanted to do. So Jeffrey felt he was entitled at age 10 to do what the heck he wanted to do. Father was a firefighter. He was out of the house regularly, and mother was working full time, and it was difficult to keep this kid under control, I would say. And it was just not contemplated that anything really dangerous would do. Cambridge is not a dangerous town. It borders Boston, as I mentioned, but it's not a crime-ridden town by any stretch of the imagination. It's a wealthy town. So therefore, there are, I think, slightly extenuating circumstances in this particular case. Unfortunately, though, that he was befriended by these two guys who offered him a bike. They hung around together on more than this one occasion, and it led to bad things.
And I guess that's the profile. When you talk about predators, what we hear all the time is they're looking for that child, that victim, who they can get to. They're looking for a child that may have an adequate supervision, a child that's coming from a family life where they're looking for love or companionship or someone who shows that they care about the child. And I guess that is shown here. The fact that they enticed him or seduced him by offering to purchase him a bike.
Right. I'm not exactly sure, but I believe he rode around with these guys a couple times before and felt safe with them. They were grooming him.
Yeah, part of the grooming process.
And the bike was a definite enticement. And when they told him, well, okay, today's the day we're going to go take you to get a bike. That was it. He was in the car. Let's go, unfortunately.
This has been a very sad case review. You can tell when I get kind of overwhelmed with emotion because I don't say a lot when you're describing what happened to him.
I think it was 2 days later after the discovery of Jeffrey's body, the evidence response team and I executed a search warrant at Carl Jane's apartment in New Hampshire. I went in with other members of the evidence response team. And once we walked into that apartment, it was like walking into a 9-year-old's bedroom. There was stuffed animals. There were toys. There was Lion King posters on the wall. And I thought, my God, this is a den. How many other kids have been lured to this den? And it told me a lot about the psyche of Carl Jaynes. And he viewed himself, I think, as a kid. And maybe that made it easier for him to be a molester, a monster.
How old was he?
He was 22. Overweight, didn't score with the girls too well, and probably didn't want to. We collected all that evidence as well, and I believe it was introduced at trial. I wasn't there for the entire trial. I'm not sure exactly what was introduced. That was an eye-opening experience. I had never gone into a pedophile's residence, but it all made sense when we did that.
I think the significant thing about this case that we should note is the fact that I asked you earlier why the Cambridge Police Department called the FBI in. And of course, we all hear about abductions and kidnappings and 24 hours and going across state line. I've talked about this many times on the show, that when it comes to missing children, none of that really matters. The FBI is going to jump in as soon as the request for assistance is made. But in this particular case, the FBI's involvement, you can see how needed it was, because the bottom line is it involved three states.
Right, exactly. That's true. Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Maine. And we were so glad to help. It was a case tailor-made for the FBI, and we worked so well with all the other police agencies that this case came together seamlessly. There was no bickering. There was no disputes over who does what. We just came to a general consensus. This is how we're going to work the case. Everybody will do reports on what they did, and those reports will be crucial for testimony wherever trial ends up being. It was that camaraderie that allowed us to not make mistakes and not stumble and allowed us to continue on and find Jeff's body. It could have been easy to give up, I think, after the first time we searched the river and came up with nothing, to spread out and start looking at every other river. But really, everybody thought that the description given by Sicari was ideal for this particular location. And thank God we stuck to it, or the divers stuck to it. It was their job. They were in this murky bottom. They couldn't see beyond a foot in front of their face. And they miraculously came across the container with Jeff's body as it had been hung up in the branches of that tree that had fallen into the river. Had that tree not been there, I don't know how far this thing would have gone or if we would have ever found it. I remember thinking the first day walking along the bank of the river, I said, geez, look at this tree. It's in the water. I wonder if that could be anything. The divers at that point didn't see it. It wasn't because they weren't looking, but the visibility was extremely poor. The second day, they paid more attention to the tree area, and they were lucky. They found it.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I guess the last thing that we need to talk about is sentencing. What happened to Salvador Sicari and Carl Jaynes? What kind of time did they get?
Well, they're still in prison. Jaynes came up for parole and it was denied. Sal Sicari is in for life. And I think Carl Jaynes is in for life as well, natural life. Because second degree murder can be a life sentence if you're not allowed parole. Neither one of them will ever be paroled. I can't see the parole board acting on their behalf at all, determining them to be rehabilitated.
every time there's a parole hearing, there's an army of people there trying to make sure it doesn't happen. So far, it hasn't, and I don't think it will.
This has been fascinating and sad, sitting here thinking about this poor 10-year-old little boy and his family.
Kids that age, it really struck home for me. I can't imagine the grief, the suffering of that family. And I just thank God that so far, all my daughters and all my grandkids have been safe and will hopefully continue to be safe.
Yes. Amen on that. And the same for me and for every single person who is listening to this episode. We want to keep our children safe and never have to experience anything like this. Just the thought of it is sad and horrifying. Let's talk a little bit more about your book. I know that a large part of it is the Loomis Fargo vault robbery attempt and the sting that you set up for that. But is this case, this Jeffrey Curley case, mentioned in the book too?
It is, yes. This case happened before my investigation of the Loomis Fargo case. And therefore, in the book, I start by talking a little bit. I don't get too detailed about my background, but I do talk about being a police officer in the city of Sterling Heights, Michigan, getting into the detective bureau and going from the detective bureau to the FBI after a fellow detective said, hey, the FBI is looking for agents. And I said, oh, really? What's it take? And he said, you need to have 3 years of professional experience and you have to have a bachelor's degree. And I had a bachelor's degree and I had 6 years of relevant police experience. So I decided, what the heck? I'd apply to the FBI. When you go in the FBI, you're going to leave wherever you're at and may never get home again. That's something that you have to agree to as well. I can sense there would be situations where a guy, say, perhaps the husband was really like to become an FBI agent and the wife is thinking, I don't want to leave my mother and father, maybe. But if that isn't resolved, and you know about this, Jerry, that oftentimes agents get transferred to places they don't want to be. There's problems in the family and they either quit or their marriage breaks up. It's not easy. But in my case, luckily, my wife was all on board. And she's been with me for the ride and has been a trooper all along.
Your book, The Con and the FBI Agent, An Unlikely Alliance, where again, you talk a little bit about your background and what you did before you became an FBI agent and some of the other cases that you worked. But it really does concentrate a lot on your relationship with your informant, Tony Romano, and the successful criminal investigation and undercover sting operation. Go back and listen or re-listen to episode 130.
Yes, absolutely. And boy, did you hit it on the head. Informants, you know how the Bureau pounds the agents to develop informants.
Absolutely. Sometimes
agents will get paper informants. In other words, they'll write up somebody just to satisfy their requirement to develop an informant that's not really any damn good.
I'm excited for you to have this book out in the world. Where can people get the book?
The book can be ordered online through Amazon, also through Barnes & Noble. If you want to just Google The Con and the FBI Agent, An Unlikely Alliance, or Google my name, David Nadolski, you'll come up with the book. But I would recommend actually going directly through my publisher, which is Roman and Littlefield, because they are offering, number one, their price for the book is lower than bookstore prices to begin with. And they're offering a 30% discount if you order directly from them. And that would be capital RLFANDF, and then the number 30. All you have to do is provide that code, RLFANDF30, if you call, order the book at 717-794-3800, or go to their website, roman.com/Lexington, LEXINGTON.
All right. Most people are listening to this episode and they may not have pen and paper with them, but don't worry about it. I will put all of that information in the show notes for this episode so that you can get that discounted price for this fabulous book. Normally, I would ask when and why you joined the FBI, but you've answered that. But I am going to ask you to give us the last word. What would you like to say?
I would like to say that talking about this case, it was an emotional experience, extremely emotional for me and for everybody involved. It was probably the most important case I've ever worked. I can't imagine how things would have turned out if we had not discovered that body. We would not have discovered that body had Sal Sicari not flunked his polygraph. That was the key, because I know these two guys would have clammed right up when charged. And if we couldn't find the body, we couldn't prosecute him. But that polygraph test was a truly important avenue to getting to the truth behind this case. And as I said, I think about this case all the time. And I'm just so glad we got it solved. Unfortunately, it ended that way, but there's nothing we could have done about that.
And that's the end of the interview. In your podcast app's description of this episode, you'll find a link to the show notes on my website, jerrywilliams.com, where you'll find a photo of Dave Nadowski and a photo of the adorable little Jeffrey Curley, as well as links to news articles and a video about the kidnapping and murder investigation. And don't forget, there are also links to where you can buy Dave's book, The Con and the FBI Agent, An Unlikely Alliance, at a 30% discount. There's also links to episode 130, where he reviews the Loomis Fargo vault sting. You'll also find a link to where you can listen to more case reviews focused on crimes against children. I hope you enjoyed the interview and that you'll share it with your friends, family, and associates. You can show me just how much you liked it by buying me a coffee. There's a link in your podcast app's description of this episode, or you can visit jerrywilliams.com and tap on the little coffee cup icon in the bottom right-hand corner of my website. Don't forget to follow FBI Retired Case File Review on your favorite podcast app. Now, this podcast is all about true crime, but if you're also interested in crime fiction, once a month, via my reader team email, I keep you up to date on the FBI and books, TV, and movies. When you join my reader team, you get access to my FBI reading resource, a colorful list of more than 70 books about the FBI written by FBI agents who have been guests on this podcast. There's nonfiction, crime fiction, true crime, and memoirs. You'll also get my FBI reality checklist, where I debunk 20 cliches about the FBI and receive news about what I'm up to and about my FBI nonfiction and crime fiction books. I want to thank you for listening to the very end. I hope you come back for another episode of FBI Retired Case File Review with Jerry Williams. Thank you.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.